everyone, welcome back to A11 Crypto, and today we are going to dive into the institutional VC market again, but this time with someone who has a long history of doing investing and doing evangelizing and working with projects in the Silicon Valley. Now, today's guest is Mikko Matsumura, and he is well known within the circle, but maybe new to our friends and listeners who may not be from Silicon Valley. So maybe, Mikko, why don't you give us a little bit about how did your story start in the Valley?
Yeah, so if we go back to the origin, I actually have my graduate degree, which is a master's degree in neuroscience from Yale University. Really, it was abstract computational neural networks. So in a sense, I'm qualified to be an AI person. But the thing that is kind of amazing about the twists and turns is, you know, for a brief time, I was doing the seed stage machine learning investment fund. But, you know, in the end, I really got into blockchain the most. So, you know, I think during my career in Silicon Valley, I've been open source software, you know, really since the beginning. My first job was as a developer evangelist at Sun Microsystems, the founder of Java language. So, you know, I was pretty much here at the beginning of the Java programming language. And, you know, that was kind of where I got my taste for open source software. So, you know, ever since then, I've been working on the open source software movement. And I think blockchain is almost the quantum evolution of open source. So, you know, I think it's really been a tremendous, you know, gain for the community and a really exciting field. So, you know, that's kind of how I got involved, you know. So it really has been 25 years of entrepreneurship and more like 2 years plus of venture capital. So venture capital is still pretty new, but, you know, I recently made a blog post about some of the unicorn and decacorn and dodecacorn companies that have sprung up in our portfolio. So, you know, I think it's been a tremendously fruitful few years in venture capital. So, you know, I'm happy about that. And I look, you know, talk about these amazing entrepreneurs.
Yeah, I think I always had this impression. I think, like, if you are if you're an entrepreneur, if you have been there, done that, then you're much better placed, right? Than in my view, a guy from Wall Street, you know, with a investment banking degree, and hey, you know, I can do deals for you. I think it's very different. Two approaches. You know, I know right now you are a general partner at Gumi Crypto's Capital. So maybe
that's right.
Tell us a bit more about what you do there.
Yes, absolutely. So, Gumi Crypto's Capital, or what we call GCC, really has four operating members, investment professionals. So there's three of them in the San Francisco Bay Area. One is an associate. So we have two partner level folks in the Bay Area, including myself. And then we have one partner in Tokyo. And so we have this kind of sort of globe spanning and Asia to US kind of thesis. And, you know, we tend to bring our portfolio companies into the Japan market and give them access to liquidity and exchanges. And we give them access to a lot of really interesting people there. And I think for us, that's given us a really nice niche in order to get involved in a lot of really high power deals, you know, and it has given us a real special sort of role in the industry. So, you know, I think as far as what do I do at GCC, you know, I'm definitely part of the general partnership. And, you know, in some ways, when you put together a partnership, everyone kind of takes a different kind of a role. I tend to be the public face. So, you know, I have, you know, a show. You can see it at miko.com, miko.com/bits, BITS. So you can just check it out. But, like, you know, I've interviewed more than 50 DeFi and NFT leaders on my show. And so, like, you know, that in some ways I'm the front man. So, you know, I think I'm the visible face of GCC. You know, and I tend to be kind of the more gregarious and friendly face of the fund. So that's kind of my role mostly.
And then you mentioned, you know, those high power deals, right? I think recently you guys have been on the front pages a lot in whether that's I think Crunchbase or TechCrunch about these high power deals. So why don't you maybe give us a few names of these?
Absolutely, absolutely. So as far as Signal production, you know, one of the high flyers for us is OpenSea. So, you know, as everybody knows, the NFT movement is kind of taken hold in the popular imagination. And I think the thing that's carrying NFT is this vision that all intellectual property can become governed by a system of fairness, right? And true ownership, right? And that this idea that blockchain helps to disintermediate participants, especially ones that are not adding additional value across an open internet, right, is really exciting, right? So, you know, in a sense, what we're going to see in the NFT space is that while blockchain-based cryptographic assets will assume the value of all financial assets, right, NFT will assume the value of all intellectual property. Right. So I think that, you know, that obviously that will take some time.
Yeah.
But OpenSea indexes over 14 million NFTs, although that number grows crazily fast. So maybe 15 or 20 million by now. But, you know, it's sort of almost the Google and the eBay and the Unity SDK of NFT. Right. So OpenSea has really deeply embedded itself in the industry. And, you know, recently they announced a round that was led by Andreessen Horowitz, you know, $23 million round. So, you know, for us, that's been one huge win in terms of our notoriety, right? Because obviously, you know, we're a small, very small fund, you know, a $30 million US dollar fund, you know, so it gives us good swagger to have Andreessen Horowitz following, you know, and obviously driving a much higher up round price for OpenSea. You know, so I think in a way, people are taking notice and they're saying, how did Gumi get ahead of Andreessen? And I think the answer is pretty simple, which is, you know, we have my co-founder and general partner in Tokyo actually founded a publicly traded mobile gaming company called Gumi. That's where we get our name. And he actually, his company Gumi actually became a the owner of a company called Double Jump Tokyo, which publishes My Crypto Heroes. And so that's a very early NFT blockchain game.
Okay.
And so in a sense, we developed in-house expertise on these kind of collectible, tradable, and playable NFTs, right? So in a sense, we kind of have a background in gaming and, you know, we kind of developed an expertise in-house. So we were able to kind of see this deal ahead of like the crowd. You know, and obviously NFT is here and it's here really big. So, you know, I think that was one that we picked early. It's definitely not our biggest. It's not, you know, OpenSea is not yet a unicorn, whereas projects like Theta it's a dodecacorn already. You know, Celsius is a very, very clear head and shoulders unicorn that's headed to become a decacorn, you know, so there's definitely, you know, bigger deals in the portfolio, but I would say that OpenSea is one that I think is currently kind of white hot in terms of the topic and in terms of the other investors. You know, the other people that came into that round are of course pretty famous Silicon Valley people like Tim Ferriss and, you know, others. So, you know, it's been gratifying.
Yes. Yes. 4-Hour Work Week. I read that book.
Yeah. So there's a lot of famous people jumping into OpenSea. So, you know, we're super happy for the team. You know, I think in a way that kind of star power is meaningful in that sector, right? It's not like enterprise software. No, you actually do want people who are sort of pseudo celebrities, and you want some of that because, you know, there's sort of a Hollywood thing going on with NFTs.
Yeah. That's super interesting. You know, I find it fascinating. You mentioned, you know, Theta, Celsius. These are all, you know, I think, you know, top 20 or 30 projects on CoinMarketCap or CoinGecko. And, you know, you say yourself, you know, you are a $30 million fund, right? I cannot think of a single fund of that size getting into these kind of deals way early? You know, okay, I guess a question is, what's the secret sauce? And also, what is your investment thesis?
Oh, I appreciate that. So I think the special sauce for us is, I think the thesis is part of the special sauce. You know, I think we are a very, I would say, pure VC model fund. So in a sense, we invest in conviction, right? But obviously, as a conviction-based investment process, you know, we really love founders. So we're very obsessed with kind of like founders. And, you know, we kind of look for these, you know, what we call gummy corn founders, you know, and these are the types of people that we, you know, affiliate with. You know, we try to be as open and gregarious as possible. So we try to meet everybody. And then, you know, through that process, we try to filter and discover, you know, who these early stage founders are. I do think that you're right. All of our partnership at Gumi have kind of built and exited companies at significant valuations, you know, including, you know, IPO. So I think that because of those experiences, in a sense, we have a nice harmony where I think we're able to recognize people a certain good way. And I think the other trick is that we're able to kind of sympathize with them in a good way, right? So in a sense, like a lot of times founder entrepreneurs may not look like much, you know, like it's funny. It's a sort of a diamond in the rough quality, right? Where we identify someone and we're like, people don't think much of this person right now. You know, but, you know, you can just kind of identify that, you know, this person's like, oh, well, but they have what it takes, right? They really have what it takes. Because really in the venture game, venture capitalists are forced to look for problems that can be solved using money, right? And there are some problems that cannot be solved by any amount of money, you know? And so like, in a sense, what we do is we try to find the perfect complement for, you know, because once you start to scale, you can solve all of the money problems with money, you know, and you know, there are companies and projects where there's just this, there's problems that can't be solved with any amount of money. And, you know, that those are the ones that don't make it. So.
And so give us a better idea of what are some of these problems that cannot be solved with money, right? Because I think once a project goes into scaling stage, right, then it's a flying wheel, right? You just roll forward, right?
Yeah.
But before that happens, right? Like, how do you? I think you're the best person to maybe answer this kind of question. Is that what do you look for in a founder, right? Like, how do you filter them? Because, you know, a lot of guys would say, you know, looking for product or industry founder fit, right? Does this person have a deep industry, you know, knowledge experience? And I think that's logical. But then there may be something more than that, right? Like, for example, you know, you were in OpenSea before Andreessen was there, right? So, what was that like? You know, what did you see?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, for us, like, we just really kind of love the founding team, Devin and Alex. Like, the two of them are, you know, incredibly, they were incredibly hardworking, passionate, scrappy, and in a sense, their approach wasn't too dissimilar to kind of our philosophy, only they were focused on NFT, right? So in a sense, if there was like any creators in the early days, you know, they were pursuing them and they were listing them. And they kind of built this social network of NFT, right? So in a sense, like it scaled to the point where they don't know every single person making an NFT anymore, but there was a point in the industry where they knew everyone. They really, you know, hustled to kind of like build these relationships with all the creators. And, you know, for us, when we saw that, we knew that there was something really lasting. There's something very durable, right? Because in a sense, when you look at that kind of behavior, it's sort of hyper energetic. It's hyper, you know, they're just very passionately connecting people, right? So in a sense, when you see that, that's a precondition, right? Now, obviously, as you get into the mode where you're kind of in hyper growth, you know, a couple of things that are really irreplaceable, you know, we do think experience is great. I mean, obviously, we have some future Gumicorn founders that are first-time entrepreneurs, underrepresented entrepreneurs. So we definitely invested in really happily and successfully in, you know, new people.
Yeah.
But sometimes experience helps, you know. Other times, one of the really important scaling things that can't be solved with money is hiring you know, I think you have to be good at that. And then the other thing that's really important for properties of scaling, you know, but I think for an early stage fund, a lot of the focus is more on things that are meta, like coachability, right? So, you know, if you have someone who has some coachability, you know, even if we're not the coaches, you know, that they are able to take input and pivot and be dynamic, right? Because in a sense, like, you know, the thing that's so funny is that there's this really it's super complicated, right? Because some of the entrepreneurs have really hard heads.
Yeah.
You know, and you have to have a hard head because people are throwing rocks at your head all day, you know? And so in a sense, stubbornness is really important. But the thing that's so funny is you can't just close your helmet and be like, okay, throw as many rocks as you want. You know, I'm just going to ignore all of you, right? It's like, right. No, you still have to listen to someone. You have to listen to someone at the end of the day. You know, you have to be open, right? So how do you get that incredibly kind of complex mix of openness and kind of security, right? Hardness and endurance and perseverance, you know? So that's a real weird and miraculous equation.
Yeah. I guess, you know, maybe in essence, you know, people think about is that as a founder, you must be incredibly stubborn in pursuing the solution to the problem, right? You need to be obsessed by it because these are very hard things. For people maybe who have not tried to start a company, when you do start a company to solve something, you have so many problems, right? All you did all day is just troubleshooting, right? And that gets you exhausted very quickly, to be very honest, right? I tried it and I failed. And so that's why I know this, right? But then at the same time, right, I guess you also need to be able to take in the feedbacks, right? And then there's more of an art than a science, right? Because, I mean, there's no formula to it, right? It's just that it happens that maybe you have the right person in your circle and you are able to get the advice and then move forward, adjust your behavior.
Let me give you a pattern.
Okay.
That, you know, because VCs, successful VCs are unfortunately stuck pattern matching, and successful entrepreneurs are generally pattern breaking, right? Uh-huh. And so in a sense, that's the kind of conundrum of making this efficient, right? So the value chain and supply chain in VC is highly, highly inefficient because of this mismatch, right? But to me, the thing that's so interesting when you boil it down is one of the things that we really, really love are co-founders. We love co-founders, right? Because in a way, co-founders are the way that the stubbornest people in the world get cracked open, right? And the way they get cracked open is kind of almost through their heart, right? Which is that they just embrace the other person. Yep. You know, so even if the person is like the classic template, which is almost a joke now, is like Steve Jobs, Steve Wozniak, right? Where like, you know, like Steve Jobs was kind of a bully and kind of a, you know, just an incredibly obstinate, difficult, stubborn, like extremist, right? But he would listen to Steve Wozniak, right? Like, you know, Steve Wozniak would have opinions, and Steve Wozniak was the absolute freaking genius, you know? So when Steve Jobs came and said, oh, I got the contract with Atari, like Nolan Bushnell's in, we're going to be building single player Pong, you know, see if you can figure this out, you know? And like, so the relationship between the two of them, like, so to me, if it was Steve Jobs alone, right, in a sense, there's a danger that he creates this kind of kingdom of his own ego, right? But like, if you see a Steve Wozniak, then you're like, oh, I see. Like, these two are back to back. They're bonded together. They're going to go through thick and thin, right? And the other thing that's really kind of an important pattern is to try to kind of figure the relationship out, right? To be like, you know, what's the relationship like? Because we kind of have a feeling of what the individuals are like. What's the relationship like? Because in a sense, you know, if it, if that comes apart, then you're kind of, that's that no amount of money can solve like a founder breakup, right? Like if the two of them kind of just bust, like it's over, like the company's over and whatever, you know, obviously you can still recover and become a unicorn, but like, you know, it becomes a new company. Like, you know, the thing you invested in isn't fixable anymore.
I love this, right? I think this is, you can only get to this part of the conversation if you have been through it, right? Or if you've been there seeing it, right, firsthand. And that speaks to your experience, I think, in the industry. Because, you know, in crypto these days, every single day you have a new VC popping up, right? And who knows what's behind it, right? And that's, and for me, that's really funny. You know, same thing happened in the last cycle. But, when we see, I guess, you know, previously who are the people who are entrepreneurs themselves and doing this, you know, that's when I get excited, right? That's why, you know, for me, you know, that's why I look into, you know, Gumi and try to figure out what you guys are doing, and super interesting. I mean, so you know, now we talk, you know, you give us insights, and I think this is maybe a very valuable insight into what you look for in founders, right? Do you guys, you know, investing, you know, single founders or that's a hard pass now?
No, we absolutely have. We absolutely have. And by the way, there are some cases where there are single founders that kind of are almost kind of towers of strength, you know, and in a way their co-founders and their partners, you know, in a way are kind of, you know, there's a kind of a reverence around the founder, right? So there's sort of co-founders that may be a little bit different than you know, and maybe not completely equal, right? And uh-huh. But in those cases, it still can be, right? Because you know, like for example, if you look at like an Elon Musk, like as a personality, he's kind of a hyper strong personality, right? So in a sense, it's kind of Elon Musk and like kind of everyone else. I mean, I know it's a very pejorative thing, you know, but like the thing that's really important is to try to then understand if there are people that are kind of in more in the shadows, like how are they being treated, you know, because like, you know, obviously, you know, nobody can build a unicorn by themselves, right? So even if they're like this tower of strength, like you still want to understand that they're able to like hire people, they're able to delegate, they're able to, you know, even if all the other participants are kind of like not the sort of, they're not a queen, king pin or like a queen or like a, you know, some, they're not the kind of supreme ruler, but they can still participate, right? So these things take different forms, but like at the end of the day, the thing we're looking for is that kind of, you know, because the reason why this combination is so important is because the founder needs to connect what I call heaven and earth, right? And earth is really business execution, right? So for example, if you look at the early Apple computer, you know, Steve Jobs got that contract with Atari. It's like, that's a great contract, right? Those guys got to eat lunch that day, you know, yeah. Like they're just surviving, right? They're really trying to get, you know, so in a sense, when we talk about earth, we're talking about just grounded execution, right? And sometimes one of the things about early stage is sometimes grounded execution looks really ugly. Mm-hmm. Like sometimes, you know, and it doesn't look beautiful, you know, but at the same time, you know, if you look at the Steve Jobs thing, like Steve Jobs had a big idea, and the idea that he had was so big because the Steve Jobs' big idea was personal computing, right? And the thing that's amazing is like, if you think about people with a smaller idea, right? Like let's say Steve Jobs' smaller idea was, I'm just gonna make some bucks and then maybe I'll retire, that'll be cool, right? He delivered the Apple II. I don't know if you remember this machine, but like he delivered the Apple II, and it's kind of like, wow, like the Apple II was kind of almost like the peak of personal computing. It was like, that's such an amazing personal computer, you're a genius, right? It could have been,
That the first computer with GUI or
no, it was that was pre-GUI. It was still all command line. It was still really weak, right? Obviously, the thing that really was the breakout for him after that was the Macintosh, right? But like in some sense, it was the invention of the personal computer, right? And even IBM even called their first personal computer, the PC. And that's why we call them PCs, right? Because it's the IBM PC, the personal computer, right? But in a sense, they were responding to Steve Jobs, right? Because Steve Jobs, because the idea of a personal computer was just nonsense. Like nobody, no person would own a computer. That just made no sense, right? So in a sense, personal computer, the thing, but the reason why I call it a big idea is Apple continues to deliver more and more and more and more personal computing devices. You know, next up is going to be their headset, their AR VR headset, right? So, I mean, that's pretty personal. Like Siri knows the sound of your voice, you know, Face ID knows what your face looks like, you know, so how personal can it get, right? So he didn't quit, like he was, you know, so to me, that's what I call heaven, right? So in a sense, heaven and earth, right? It's hard. That's the reason why these kinds of relationships are so important, right? Because in some sense, finding the span of heaven and earth in a single individual is like, it's super duper rare. And the other part becomes that, you know, if you do find kind of heaven and earth in a single person, sometimes that person is so sort of extreme that they can't, you know, they can't even work with someone else. And, you know, at that point, you might not have something that can grow.
Wow. Yeah. This is like super alpha, like in my view, right? Like, but it's super, it's also super pragmatic and practical, I would say, because, you know, if I think back to, you know, you basically need to have two different types of framework inside your mind to execute on the heaven part, the vision part, and the business execution part, right? The requires a very different frame of mind.
Totally,
right? And you know, I think you know the execution part. You know, some guy may be great at I don't know sales, right? But then his frame of mind is very different from some guy who's a visionary, right? I can see this.
Yes.
Where do I find people like that? I want to know. I would love to have a list of people like that and talk to every single one of them. Have you met those people in your work?
Absolutely. Those are my gumicorns, you know, like, you know, that's the thing that's been amazing for us, right? Like, you know, if you look in the DeFi segment, like, you know, obviously the 1inch team, incredible, like product executors, you know, so they're kind of a gumicorn to be. I think their current kind of coin market cap is about 660 million. So I think they're not yet at the billion level, but they will be, I think, I'm confident, you know, and they're just amazing at grounded product execution. They're just, you know, really prolific at building product, you know, and we have a couple that are kind of pre-mainnet, which is like Agoric, you know, Vega protocol, you know, those are kind of, because to me, the thing that's amazing about kind of I agree with you that these kinds of the heaven and earth thing is basically, you know, how do you make something real? Right. Because in a sense, what we're talking about is we're talking about moving something from, you know, the unreal to the real. Right. We're talking like, for example, like Steve Jobs was obsessed with building his iPhone. Right. And in a sense, the iPhone was born inside of his imagination. Right. Like, you know, so it wasn't real. Like, so he was basically like, this is something that's not real. And he's like, yeah, but I really am obsessed about it. Like, like this thing that isn't real is going to become real and I'm going to make it real. And the thing is that, you know, imagine the imagination of it is part of the heavenly part, but the earth part is making it real. And obviously that's execution. And so execution is kind of irreplaceable, right? It's irreplaceable. So in a sense, like this kind of combination is really, it's very mysterious and it's pretty rare, right? Like you have to look at that and be like, you know, and so all of these become investments, become a hypothesis, right? They become a hypothesis around like, okay, well, how do we see this playing out? You know, how do we see this, you know, because ultimately like you have to, the company has to kind of feed itself, right? I mean, that's why very seminal works like Geoffrey Moore's Crossing the Chasm become really interesting, because he talks about how early adopters kind of fuel the company. And the reason why this kind of pattern has become so fundamental in venture capital is because you kind of have to get to Series A, Series B, you have to get to kind of your growth round, like you have to get to these milestones. And the reason why these milestones are so important is because obviously there's a huge inflection, right? So in a sense, one of the things that Geoffrey Moore posited in Crossing the Chasm, his seminal book, is that some of the skills that gets you to the chasm are the opposite of the skills you need on the other side of the chasm. And in fact, the emblematic story coming back to Steve Jobs is really the thing that happened is, you know, I think the olden days, Steve Jobs actually was not able to cross the chasm at Apple, you know, because of John Sculley, right? So, you know, in a sense, like he kind of hired John Sculley to be CEO of Apple, you know, because he felt like he could scale the company, right? So in a sense, it's kind of like build the company, create the company, scale the company, you know. So even Steve Jobs was kind of suspecting that he might not be the guy to scale it, you know. And I think obviously he learned, everybody learned a bunch of really different lessons from Steve being removed. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. Wow. Oh man. Like this is the best conversation I had with a VC guy. Because I you know, you gave a lot of practical examples. And I mean, so you know, we have a, you know, an idea of what sort of founders and what's the process that you go through to look for them. I mean, how do you do that in today's Zoom world, right? How can you even see that in the Zoom world, right?
I'm super happy to hear you say that, because to be honest, it's very hard. It's very hard. I would say that there's a couple of things. So I recommend Jason Calacanis's book Angel, and one of the things that Jason promotes is updates, right? Mm-hmm. So there's something brilliant about updates. Now I realize this is kind of maybe a little bit of a cynical thing, but like, one of the ways to measure execution, like the thing that's measurable is execution, right? So, you know, there are some things that are unmeasurable, like passion is kind of something that's qualitative, right? Yeah. So you have to kind of like try to get an understanding of it. So like in a sense, you know, references help a lot. So, you know, really talking to people who know the person, that helps a lot. You know, I think product experience helps a lot. So for example, you know, I mentioned 1-inch exchange. So like in the DEX aggregator space and DeFi space, like, you know, one of the early experiences I had with the 1-inch team is just using their product, right? So that's so the thing that happened in my experience of their product is that it was the perfect product at the perfect time. And then all of a sudden the product started mutating under my eyes. Like every time I would use it, it would have new features, you know, and then it became the perfect product for the second wave of DEX and DeFi, right? And so for me, I was kind of like, wow, they were able to ride the first wave and now they're riding the second wave. Like, you know, so it's clear even without kind of having deep personal relationships that there's a prolific engine of productivity back there, you know? So I think that that's one, you know, and obviously in the DeFi segment, there are people who are kind of like, trust the smart contracts and not the people, you know, we don't go that far, you know, like we don't go that far because the people are the creators, you know? So for us, you know, we want to, as a venture firm, we're really a software venture firm. So like, you know, we want people to take the money from us and our LPs, and we want them to convert that into software, you know? And so that's, the people are the linchpin, obviously, you know, but in terms of the COVID phenomenon and quarantine, you're absolutely right that this is one of the hardest parts of doing so, but we've tried to keep a steady pace going of investment even through this, you know, and we're absolutely, you know, proud of the, you know, investments that we've made through this period. Another trick is to invest in people who you've known for years. So for example, we recently invested in Yield Guild games, and that was YGG. So I've known Gabby for years, and you know, I've known Beryl for a shorter time, but still possibly measurable in years. And so in a way, that's another bit of a trick too, right? Which is, if you've known them for years, you have a better feeling. Because obviously the thing that's crazy about things like DeFi is that, you know, there's rug pulling, there's all kinds of crazy shenanigans, right? Yeah. So like, in a sense, there's even just the basic question of like, you know, are you know, is an investee going to run with the money? I mean, one of the things that's been really gratifying is despite COVID and everything else, you know, we've yet to have a Gumi portfolio company rug pull or run away with our money, or, you know, they've all executed, in a incredibly satisfying way. So, you know, I think that's been good, but, you know, I agree with you. The COVID phenomenon has been super hard.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's difficult to filter these qualities in people through a Zoom call. That's why I think if you know people, and that reminds me, like, Gabby was doing mobile gaming for a long time, right? And maybe that's how you guys know him. Yeah,
absolutely. He's the president of the the Gaming Society of the Philippines. You know, he's been a game studio developer. Right. You know, he's definitely been just a super visible entrepreneur.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I would occasionally meet him in different places around the world, you know, whether I'm in the Philippines or, you know, we met in New York, like, uh-huh. You know, we met a bunch of places all over the world, you know, so in a sense, like, you get a feeling like that, you know, and that obviously the meetings are all in-person meetings are all pre-COVID, you know, but, you know, I think that's kind of a way of developing a really strong feeling about a person. You know, and you develop kind of shared social network, right? Yeah. So, you know, when you have shared social network, then you kind of feel like, all right, well, you know, everybody that's kind of doing business with this person trusts them. And, you know, so it all starts to kind of click.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to have an episode with them soon. So look forward to that. You know, before COVID, right, just to give us a bit more understanding of what it looks like. So before this whole lockdown thing, you know, from your point of view, did you just travel constantly because you have to?
I kind of did. To
I don't
be
think
honest.
You like that, judging by your reaction.
You know, I mean, to me, I'm fueled by kind of my passions, right? So in a sense, like that was a natural thing to do, and I definitely was hugely rewarded, not just like financially, of course, but like more about the conversations, right. The humans, the knowledge, the excitement, the friendships, you know, like, so really being a member of a community, like, you know, it's been tremendously rewarding. You know, we still have, there's some still wonderful groups that I, you know, hang out with in group Zooms. And so, you know, really community has been tremendously nourishing, you know, but I would say that my reaction is more to kind of the travel industry, you know, and obviously things like TSA security checks and it's just there's an unpleasantness to kind of just even getting to places these days.
I mean American customs have a way of grading people. But okay, so you know, I think we talk about a lot of projects. You mentioned a lot of projects. So what are the maybe the investment thesis in terms of the verticals that you look into, you're interested in?
Yes, absolutely. So our mindset is very much so my personal thesis in the space is what I call open source financial infrastructure, right? So, you know, in a sense, when we talk about financial infrastructure, this all relates to kind of the internet of value, right? And the thing that's funny about open source is that open source by itself doesn't carry any specific business model. But of course, the existence of cryptographic assets becomes a game changer, right? So in a sense, the thing that's so fascinating about the way that it plays out is that, you know, we really think about the growth of these open source giants, right? And I think the thing that we see in any open source movement is that there are beneficiaries, right? So the question becomes, how does that play out in terms of our thesis? One of the ways it plays out is that we kind of range up and down the stack, right? So if you look at our portfolio, it's gumi-cryptos.com. You can see that we have things up and down the stack. We have applications, you know, all the way down to layer one. We're an investor in Space Mesh. You know, we have smart contracts investments in Agoric. We have, you know, Exchange. You know, we have all kinds of like infrastructure and everything else, right? So I would say that, like, you know, that's part of it. But then the other thing becomes applications, right? So when I talk about open source financial infrastructure, what you're going to see is you're going to see a preponderance of our investment focused on financial services, both DeFi and CeFi, right? And then you're going to see some amount of gaming, right? Because we feel like gamers are early adopters of every new technology. So I think that's kind of some of the things that we tend to gravitate towards. What we do think is we do think that NFT is kind of an early phenomenon because it's intellectual property, right? So when you look at the segmentation of it, we think that financial applications will dominate. And we think that intellectual property, you know, because ultimately in the big picture, it's the internet of value, right? So the question becomes what's valuable? And so we think the sequence of what's valuable is first money, then all financial assets, right? So derivatives, stocks, options, futures, contracts, like all of that is like, it's a lot like money, right? And then after that, it's intellectual property, right? After that becomes things like identity and personal data privacy and things like that, right? So in essence, we're looking for what are the assets that can be put on the internet and how can they be transferred, protected, transformed, computed, you know? And so I think, you know, there's a lot of people that are excited about a lot of applications, you know, but for us, we really think about this more from the perspective of the internet of value. And then we start to kind of back into what's most valuable and what's going to be protected first, right? So in a sense, like money is probably the first thing to value and protect, you know, after money, then all financial assets, and then after all financial assets, then all intellectual property. Right. And after all intellectual property, then it becomes things like data and identity. So, for us, and obviously identity is a little complicated. So identity is an infrastructure. So in a sense, when you build it, the applications around identity, like data privacy, you know, like where I'm a big fan of like the basic attention token in the Brave browser. Uh-huh. And like, you know, I personally, you know, jumped in on their ICO way back in the day.
Yeah.
But I would say that like, you know, as a fund, we see a play like that in terms of things like advertising and things like, we see that as being like later. Like we see it as, you know, and obviously like given the rapid acceleration of the space, you know, later may become sooner, but you know, but I, sure. but, you know, that's our mood.
Sounds like the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? Money and then financial values, assets.
I like that. And the thing that's so fascinating about what we're seeing with Abraham Maslow is that we're seeing a recapitulation of the evolution of society, right? So what I mean by that is that when you see the phenomenon of NFT, we're kind of in the Middle Ages. And what I mean by we're in the Middle Ages is that we're talking about art patronage. So if you remember the Renaissance is really about art patronage. And the question becomes, who's doing the patronage? And the patrons are basically two entities. They're sovereigns, right? They're all sovereign, right? But they're kings and queens are the patrons, right?
Yeah.
And the thing in Bitcoin is everyone is a sovereign. Right. So in a sense, we're seeing monarch. Everyone's a monarch. Right. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, like the kings and queens of Bitcoin and Ethereum are basically patrons of the arts. Right. The other entity that in the Renaissance that was like a huge art patron was the Catholic Church. So,
who's the church?
You know, if you look at, if you look at all the Ninja Turtles, you know, Michelangelo, Donatello, Raphael, like, you know, all of those artists were hired by the Catholic Church, right? Uh-huh. So like, you know, so they were one of the premier art patrons back in the Renaissance, right? So I guess, you know, and obviously we talked about Gabby in Yield Guild Gaming, right? Yeah. And so the emergence of guilds is part of this kind of era, right? So in a sense, we're talking about kind of the emergence of almost like a feudalism, you know, and I think obviously we're going to get to the emergence of kind of more like modern capitalism and this kind of thing. But like, you know, we're recapitulating kind of this development of society, you know, in blockchain.
Man, this is like super fascinating conversation, right? The analogs. I mean, it now you're painting that way. I never thought about it, right? But yeah, super, super cool, exciting to think about this. I guess, you know, so here's a question I have, right? So by money, did you mean BTC?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that it's hard to unify because I'm what I call an open source money maximalist and an open source financial infrastructure maximalist, you know, and so because of that, BTC to me has a kind of a super unique role and a super unique place in my heart. And you know, obviously, but at the same time, I'm also able to, you know, hang with the Ethereum maximalists. I'm able to hang with, you know, other maximalists, although it starts to slide a little bit from there. But like, you know, but I would say that, like, you know, to me, I feel like, you know, those are all kind of like parts of the Bitcoin universe, right? In the sense that Satoshi created a forkable open source product. You know, I don't think he would be surprised to be seeing all of the diversity, you know. So I think single coin maxis are kind of missing the bigger picture. Right. Although I would say the relationship between Bitcoin and Ethereum is fascinating. I had on my own show a great discussion with Dmitry Buterin, and he said that the birth of Ether was really kind of a rejection of the culture of scarcity that emerged in Bitcoin, right? So, you know, in a sense, Ethereum is about abundance, and it's about kind of, because it's kind of a Turing complete computational platform, it kind of has this kind of infinitely extensible thing. And in a way, the thing that's so funny about what's happening in NFT is I feel like NFT is the perfect cruise missile designed to make Bitcoin maxis insane, because in a sense, it's sort of the opposite of scarcity, right? So in a sense, it's really what the Bitcoin maxis really treasure is scarcity, you know, and in a way, the thing that's crazy about, you know, so the thing that's so insane about this NFT cruise missile is if you design a piece of art and you put it on an NFT, what you're saying is you're saying, this is incredibly scarce. Right. Uh-huh. And the reason, you know, so a super rare is the thing that people say. Right. So, you know, rarible, and you know, everyone talks about the rarity of a single asset. Right. Because uh-huh. it's a unique piece of art. Uh-huh. But of course, there's potentially an infinite number of artists. So how right. scarce could it be? Right. So in a sense, from a Bitcoin perspective, it's money printing. Right. So in a sense, like it really is almost designed to make them angry.
Interesting. I had a theory in my mind where I, you know, where I'm seeing more and more usage of layer one native, I would say, coins like Ethereum or even BNB or Solana, Luna. These things are starting being used as the basic building block on that specific chain, right? So, you know, ETH is being used as collateral, right, to mint different things, right, stable coins, and then now, you know, in my mind, I'm thinking, you know, what's interesting that like the moneyness it's been created, right? It's whatever people is going to be most widely used as that reserve, as that collateral, then that is probably going to be the most widely accepted. But just because that's most widely accepted does not mean it's the only thing that'll be accepted. And I always like to get my guests to talk about what they see in terms of, you know, what can be the moneyness, right, assets in the future. And I'm with you. I think BTC has a very unique place because of its current, I think, regulatory environment, institutional environment, simply the Lindy effect, right? But other assets, you know, also are in some ways competing through its utility. The utility may be in some ways that Bitcoin does not offer right currently, you know, in terms of, you know, if you want to mint stable coins on Ethereum, you know, I don't know what you can do with BTC. You maybe need to wrap it and then go on Ethereum, but you know, you can just use ETH. That's much easier, and so that's why I want to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think as an open source maxi, you know, I definitely think it will kind of end up being, I would say, like a fractal pattern, right? Which is, you know, if you look at a fractal, like a Mandelbrot fractal, right? It kind of looks like a turtle, right? But as you see, the turtle has turtles, right? So in a sense, it's sort of like there's a big turtle, right? So I feel like the big turtle will always be, you know, Bitcoin. And then you see a you know, so in a sense, it's kind of an 80-20, 20-20, 20-20, right? In a sense that, like, you know, every single one of these micro markets will have 80-20, you know, so you're going to see. So I think that there will be an infinite number of these on an ongoing basis, or at least a very large finite number, you know, but that at some point it becomes almost dust, right? You know, at some point, some of these become incredibly micro, you know, and, right,
right,
right. But
and
you
large
know, so I think
it has no impact basically.
Correct. So, you know, what I would expect is I would expect to see a natural power law distribution, which to me implies that Bitcoin dominance should be 50% and not 60%. And I think that in some ways it's because of the caution of people creeping into this new industry and the kind of brand halo and network effect of Bitcoin that's driving a Bitcoin 60% dominance. But I think in the steady state, I expect it to be a 50% Bitcoin dominance, you know, because of kind of a natural power law distribution. But a lot of that is just kind of personal conjecture and it's not mathematically provable. So, you know, we'll see how it shakes out.
There's no financial advice here. We are just sharing our own experience.
Exactly. That's my mood.
I guess, you know, I'm conscious of time here, right? Let's wrap this up let's talk about what are some of the interesting projects or interesting things you are looking forward to this year, whether that's in your portfolio or outside of it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we have exposure to the Polkadot ecosystem through Plasm, you know, so we're excited about that. We just did an investment in Stakewise, which is Ethereum 2 staking. So we're excited about, you know, all of the upcoming EIPs, London Fork, EIP 1559. So Ethereum ecosystem, of course, super vital, super important. Agoric launch will be exciting. You know, that's more Cosmos IBC ecosystem. You know, so we're really seeing kind of these heavy planes landing, right? We're seeing, you know, and obviously for us, we don't see any of those types of ecosystems as being ETH killers. Obviously, Plasm is EVM compatible, you know, Polkadot, Parity Substrate, kind of, you know, these are all kind of ETH extenders, right? So, you know, we're super bullish about kind of optimism and all of the kind of L2 solutions. So, you know, we continue to see this kind of tree of life and biodiversity. So, you know, for us, you know, one of the things we're looking at is kind of smart contract security and insurance, you know, so we definitely love that. And, you know, we continue to kind of heavily double down on our DeFi portfolio, you know, including Idle Finance and others.
Okay. One last question. What are some of the interesting things you have read recently, crypto or non-crypto?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that in non-crypto, I think Debt, the First 5,000 Years, is a pretty seminal book. Mm-hmm. I would highly recommend The Book of Satoshi to anyone. If you're interested in venture capital topics, I would highly recommend 0 to 1 by Peter Thiel. I mentioned Angel by Jason Calcanis. Those, I think, are canonical. So I think, you know, in investment, those are the things I would be reading, you know. And then, of course, Mastering Bitcoin by Antonopoulos is sort of super seminal for blockchainers, you know. And then, of course, The Bitcoin Standard by Safedean. I think those are all kind of like really canonical things to read. And, you know, I love Bitcoin books because Bitcoin Billionaires is another great read. Because I think people getting too much blockchain information off of YouTube, like it takes 5 minutes to say something on YouTube, they could say something really trash. Whereas if someone took the time to write a book, another Bitcoin book is The Little Bitcoin Book. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these Bitcoin books are super valuable because the amount of thought that went into them and the time and the investment, it's worth getting that knowledge.
Well, Mikos, thank you so much for the time you spent with us today. I'm super appreciative for what you have shared with us. I look forward to welcoming you back again, maybe sometime in the future.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it. And like, you know, if you want to follow me, you can go to miko.com, miko.com. And I'm Miko Java, MikoKojava on Twitter. So you can just find me there and, you know, you can see my show as well.
Absolutely.
Thanks
go
so
check out Miko Beats. That's a show on YouTube and Spotify, I believe, and follow him.